that it might have come too late, given that it would take months to put into effect. And Lehman would need to infuse the entity with at least a modicum of capital to prevent it from toppling immediately. Wiesenek then opened up the meeting to questions, and almost immediately became annoyed by the sheer volume of them posed by the J.P. Morgan bankers, most of which had nothing to do with helping Lehman raise capital. "How big is the book? What assumptions are you using around the models?" Hogan asked. "It sounds like you probably need some capital to make this whole thing work." The Lehman representatives didn't have any answers, suggesting that he get in touch with their CFO. To Wiesenek, it was obvious that what the queries were really about was determining Lehman's liquidity position, whether counterparties were trading with it, and the status of its cash position. These were all legitimate concerns that any prudent investor might have, but in this case, Wiesenek and Whitman suspected that they were intended more as a means to protect J.P. Morgan. Shedlin's questions, in contrast, were directed at various possible structures of deals that could help Lehman, but he was getting drowned out by the other bankers around the table. The one point on which bankers from both sides agreed was that Lehman should not announce its SpinCo plan unless it could identify the exact hole that it needed to fill, that is, how big a capital infusion was necessary. "You don't know how much money you're going to need," Hogan told them. "By going out and announcing this, you'd only add uncertainty to the market," he warned. "You'd get crushed." Shedlin was even blunter. "Look, we think it's very dangerous for you guys to lay out a strategy with a SpinCo where people basically will conclude that you guys still have a very significant capital hole," he said. "Going out with a story that suggests you have a big capital hole and no solution to raising it is only going to put you at the mercy of the market even more." As the meeting broke up, two messages were clear as day to Wiesenek and Whitman. The first, forget about announcing the plan, but if you feel you must do so, be very careful about talking about raising new capital, and don't get pinned down to a specific number. It was the other, however, that made them appreciate the true depth of their predicament. You're on your own. None of the banks volunteered to offer any new credit lines. As soon as Bronstein and Hogan left the building and crossed Lexington Avenue, they called Jamie Dimon and Steve Black. "Here's the story," Hogan said, virtually shouting into his cell phone. "I think these guys are fucked." They proceeded to walk Dimon and Black through all of the details of what Lehman was preparing to announce the following day. "We have to go back and tie everything up and line up all of our contingent risks," Hogan insisted. "I don't want to take a hickey on this." From the Bank of America headquarters in Charlotte, North Carolina, Greg Curl dialed Treasury's Ken Wilson, who was still in his office, frantically fielding calls. Wilson had been expecting to hear from Curl, notifying him that he was getting on a plane to New York to begin his due diligence on Lehman. Curl, however, was phoning with very different news. "We're having an issue with the Richmond Fed," he explained. Jeff Lacker, the president of the Federal Reserve of Richmond, Bank of America's regulator, had been concerned about the bank's health and had been putting pressure on it to raise new capital ever since it had closed its acquisition of Countrywide in July. As the official overseer of banks in Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, the District of Columbia, and part of West Virginia, the Richmond Fed wielded considerable power through its regulation of capital reserves. "They've been screwing around," Curl complained to Wilson, who was hearing of this for the first time. Curl told him that at the time that Bank of America was considering acquiring Countrywide back in January, a purchase that the government had quietly encouraged to help keep that firm from imploding, the Fed had quietly promised to relax its capital requirements if it proceeded with the deal. Or at least, that's what Ken Lewis thought. Now, 2 months after the Countrywide acquisition had been completed, Lacker was threatening to force the bank to slash its dividend. Bank of America had not disclosed the conversations, hoping they'd be able to resolve the matter before the news ever leaked. The bank had been working the phones that afternoon with the Richmond Fed to try to figure out where the bank now stood with Lacker, but he was having little luck. "We're going to need your help," he told Wilson. "Otherwise, we can't move forward." Wilson recognized the gambit all too clearly. Bank of America was using the Lehman situation as a bargaining chip. The bank would help Lehman, but only if the government would do it a favor in return. Lewis, through Curl, was playing hardball. Wilson promised to look into the matter and then immediately called Paulson. You're not going to believe this. At 10 p.m., a frustrated Bart McDade was still holding court in the boardroom on the 31st floor at Lehman Brothers. He had just learned that Bank of America wasn't coming up to New York in the morning, though he didn't yet understand exactly why. "We're playing against the clock," he railed. Hours earlier, McDade had implored Full to go home and get some sleep before tomorrow's earnings call, for which he needed to be on his best form. Since Fold left, he had been reviewing various drafts of the press release. What should they say? What could they say? How should they say it? McDade had just finished coaching Lowett, his CFO, through his part of the presentation when Wieseneck and Whitman returned from their meeting with J.P. Morgan and Citigroup. Before joining everyone in the boardroom, they huddled with Jerry Donini and Matt Johnson, along with a half-dozen other bankers. Whitman described the entire meeting to them. "It was unbelievable," he concluded his account, shaking his head. "It was like a J.P. Morgan risk convention." The group then joined McDade in the conference room, where, after Wieseneck and Donini walked the group through the SpinCo plan, Wieseneck shared the advice that J.P. Morgan and Citigroup had given them earlier. "We've got to be careful how we message, if we intend to raise capital or not," Donini warned. It was about 1:30 a.m., before everyone finally packed it in. A small fleet of black town cars lined 7th Avenue in front of the building to whisk the bankers home. They'd need to be back in the office only 5 hours later, giving them time for perhaps a brief nap and a shower before a day that they suspected would determine the course of their futures. Chapter 13. The day's papers for Wednesday, September 10th, 2008, were strewn everywhere in Dick Fold's office, where a sleep-deprived Bart McDade and Alex Kirk had arrived at 6:30 a.m. for last-minute preparations for the looming conference call, scheduled to begin in only 3.5 hours. The news was not good. The lead of the New York Times read, "Only days after the Bush administration assumed control of the nation's two largest mortgage finance companies, Wall Street was gripped by fears that another big financial institution, the investment bank Lehman Brothers, might founder, and that this time the government might not come to the rescue." Several paragraphs down came the quote that succinctly stated the threat that now faced them. "Some may worry that Treasury has taken on so much taxpayer burden they don't have any remaining capacity to take on the burdens of Lehman," said David Trone, an analyst at Fox Pitt Kelton. The Wall Street Journal noted the differences between what had taken place during the final days of Bear Stearns and what was now occurring at Lehman. For one thing, Lehman could borrow from the Federal Reserve. It wasn't just the stock investors who were nervous. Fold and McDade had already begun receiving reports from the trading floor that morning, indicating that more hedge funds were pulling their money out of Lehman. A sign of just how desperate the situation had become was that GLG Partners of London, whose largest shareholder, with a 13.7% stake, was Lehman, reduced the amount of business it conducted with the firm. As they were making yet another pass through the earnings call script, Kirk's cell phone rang. It was Harvey Schwartz from Goldman Sachs, phoning about the confidentiality agreement that Kirk was preparing. Before Schwartz began to discuss that matter, however, he said that he had something important to tell Kirk. "For the avoidance of doubt, Goldman Sachs does not have a client. We are doing this as principal." For a moment, Kirk paused, gradually processing what Schwartz had just said. "Really?" he asked, trying to keep the shock out of his voice. "Goldman is the buyer?" "Yes," Schwartz replied calmly. "Okay, I have to call you back," Kirk said, nervously ending the conversation, and then almost shouted to Fold and McDade, "Guys, they don't have a client." "What do you mean?" Fold asked, looking up bleary-eyed from his notes. "They're doing this for themselves, for Goldman. That's what he told me." For the next few minutes, the three men frantically brainstormed about their course of action. McDade, reasonably, was concerned about sharing information with a direct competitor. How much did they really want to divulge? At the same time, He felt they couldn't take a stand against a plan that he believed had originated with Paulson. Kirk was even more apprehensive. "Why are we letting Goldman Sachs in here? Haven't you read When Genius Failed?" The reference was to Roger Lowenstein's best-selling book about the long-term capital management crisis. In it, Goldman Sachs is depicted in one scene as trying to take advantage of the disaster by using its offer of assistance as a way to get inside long-term capital's books and download all its positions into a laptop, a charge Goldman fervently denied. "They will rape us," Kirk cautioned. McDade, turning back to his preparations for the fast-approaching call, made his position clear. "We were told by Hank Paulson to let them in the door. We're going to let them in the door." 27 floors below, Lehman traders gathered for a preview of SpinCo, the bad bank spinoff that would be discussed an hour later during the earnings call. McDade had appointed Tom Humphrey and Eric Felder to explain what investors were about to hear. After learning the details of the plan, the traders were unusually quiet, and the silence was broken only when Mohamed Grimme, global head of emerging markets, stood up with a horrified look on his face. "That's it? That's fucking it?" he asked. "Well, what the hell have those fucking idiots up on 31 been working on for the past 2 months? This? You have to be kidding me. If this is all we have, we're toast." In the time it had taken Humphrey and Felder to describe SpinCo, Grimme had already seen through it, had seen exactly what J.P. Morgan and Citigroup saw the night before, and what he feared the market would see as well. "All we've done is to take a dollar out of our right pocket and put it in our left. The heavy debt load would make it insolvent before it started," he said, backed by a growing chorus of angry muttering from the disconcerted bankers. Gregory J. Fleming, Merrill Lynch's president and chief operating officer, had one eye on CNBC as he jogged on a treadmill at the health club at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in downtown Dallas. He had spent the day before with clients in Houston and had scheduled a town hall session here with Merrill employees before hopping on a flight back to New York. As he leaned into his jog, CNBC reported that Lehman Brothers had just announced its earnings ahead of its conference call. The firm, the reporter elaborated, had also described its extraordinary spin-off plans in its press release. When Fleming returned to his room, he got a colleague to send him the announcement, which included an important headline buried at the bottom. "The firm remains committed to examining all strategic alternatives to maximize shareholder value," which meant that it was open to just about anything. He knew the company had been quietly shopping pieces of itself, but that statement effectively made it official, at least to those paying attention. Lehman, the entire firm, was up for sale. From his days as a merger banker focusing on financial services, he knew that if Lehman was on the auction block, Bank of America would be the likely buyer. But if Lehman was sold to Bank of America, the implications for his own firm, Merrill Lynch, would be enormous. He had long believed that Bank of America was the natural buyer for Merrill. At a Merrill board meeting just a month earlier, Bank of America had been listed in a presentation as just one of a handful of compatible merger partners. Fleming began trying to figure out whom he knew who might be working on a deal with Bank of America. Ed Herlihy of Wachtell, a longtime friend and one of the legal deans of banking M&A, immediately came to mind. Herlihy had worked on nearly every deal Bank of America had orchestrated over the past decade. "This is getting ugly," Fleming told Herlihy when he reached him on his cell. "How are my friends in Charlotte?" Herlihy could see where this conversation was heading and took steps to deflect it immediately. "Let's not go there, Greg," he replied. "Just tell me. If you're thinking about Lehman, you have to tell me. We could be interested in talking at some point. You and I both know it would be a much better deal." Herlihy, clearly uncomfortable, said, "We've been down this road before. We're not going to do anything unless we're invited in. If you are serious, now would be a good time to get moving on that." That was all the confirmation Fleming needed to be convinced that Bank of America was indeed bidding for Lehman. Fleming had one more call to make before his first meeting that morning. He wouldn't contact John Thane just yet. Thane, he suspected, wouldn't be interested at this point. For whenever Fleming had tried previously to discuss contingency plans to sell the bank, he had been dismissive. Instead, he phoned Peter Kelly, Merrill's deal lawyer, and recounted his conversation with Herlihy. "Look, you have to make sure Bank of America is there for us," Kelly instructed him after the two had discussed the ramifications. "You have to convince John." "That's a high bar," Fleming said. They both knew that he and Thane had a fundamentally antagonistic relationship. "I know," Kelly said, "but that's why you get paid the big bucks." Before hanging up, he made one last point. They might have to go over Thane's head. "If you can't convince John, and I know this is subversive behavior, but this is in the interest of the shareholders, you need to reach out to the board." The conference room on the 31st floor of Lehman Brothers was more crowded than usual for an earnings call. But what was typically a fairly routine affair had lately begun to be perceived as something more akin to an impeachment trial. Lehman was taking the situation seriously enough to have stocked the room with additional lawyers. Lehman technicians, meanwhile, were scrambling to ensure that the conference call and webcast would go off without a major hitch. The firm had ordered hundreds of extra phone lines to keep up with the demand. The press release issued that morning forecasted a third-quarter loss of $3.9 billion, the firm's biggest ever. Fuld strode in assuredly, as if nothing was out of the ordinary. Everyone in the room, however, knew that for years he had always let his chief financial officer handle these calls, as he had never been truly comfortable participating in them. As he took his seat at the head of the table, Fold looked around the room with his trademark disarming glare, trying to settle in with his script and papers. He knew what the stakes were. Moments earlier, he had taken a quick glance at the Bloomberg terminal to see if U.S. stock index futures might be higher on the hopes that he, Dick Fold, would be able to ease fears about Lehman. But overnight, Asian stocks had slid, and Europe was even lower. There was a lot riding on what he would say today. Millions of dollars would either be made or lost on exchanges the world over, depending on how his presentation was received. Sean Butler, the head of investor relations, looked over at his boss. "Are you ready?" "Yeah," answered Fold, faintly growling. As the call was engaged, he slowly lowered his head and launched into his script, intoning deliberately, "In light of these last 2 days, this morning we pre-released our quarterly results. We are also announcing several important financial and operating changes that amount to a significant repositioning of the firm, including aggressively reducing our exposure to both commercial real estate and residential real estate assets. These will accomplish a substantial de-risking of our balance sheet and reinforce the emphasis on our client-focused businesses. They are also meant to mitigate the potential for future write-downs and to allow the firm to return to profitability and strengthen our ability to earn appropriate risk-unadjusted equity returns." The executive summary: "Lehman Brothers will be just fine. We appreciate your concern, but we have the situation under control." "This firm has a history of facing adversity and delivering," he continued. "We have a long track record of pulling together when times are tough, and then taking advantage of global opportunities. We are on the right track to put these last 2 quarters behind us." Fold now handed off to his CFO, Lowit, who, in his clipped South African accent, outlined what Lehman billed as its key strategic initiatives. The firm would seek to sell a 55% stake in its money management business, which included Neuberger Berman, and it would spin off much of its commercial real estate holdings, otherwise known as the bad stuff. Shifting as much as $30 billion of Lehman's commercial real estate holdings, including its investments in Archstone Smith, the owner of 360 high-end apartment buildings, and SunCal, a property developer, was no small undertaking. One thing that would be changing immediately was how Lehman valued its real estate assets. Lowit continued, "The real estate held for sale portfolio, consisting of assets across the capital structure, is booked at lower cost or market as we take write-downs on this book, but do not reflect market value gains until a sale event occurs. REI Global, the new entity's infelicitous acronym, will account for its assets on a held-to-maturity basis, and will be able to manage the assets without the pressure of marked-to-market volatility, REI Global will not be forced to sell assets below what it believes to be their intrinsic value. On the surface, the spin-off appeared to be a clean, elegant solution. It removed the troubled assets from Lehman's balance sheet, leaving a stronger firm, just as Fold had indicated that it would. But what was left unsaid was precisely what had concerned the bankers at the meeting with J.P. Morgan and Citi the night before. The new company would likely need to be funded. Where was Lehman going to come up with the money to accomplish that, when it needed to retain as much capital as possible? Less than half a mile away, in his office near Grand Central Terminal, David Einhorn huddled with his team of analysts, listening to the Lehman earnings call on a speakerphone. He could not believe what he was hearing. They were still trying to avoid writing this garbage, the toxic stuff, down. What did they hope to accomplish? It was clear to him that the assets in question were worth much less than what Lehman was claiming. "There's an admission right in the press release that they're not writing these things down," Einhorn told his analysts. He zeroed in on a sentence in the company's statement. REI Global will be able to manage the assets without the pressure of mark-to-market volatility. Instead, Lehman maintained, by spinning off the real estate assets, they'd be able to account for its assets on a hold-to-maturity basis. In other words, as Einhorn continued to rail, they can keep making up the numbers however they want. Downtown, Stephen Shaffrin and a team of staffers at the New York Federal Reserve Building were also listening to the call, some of them also in a state of utter disbelief. Shaffrin, the special assistant from Treasury, had flown to New York the night before at Paulson's urging to help coordinate communication between the Treasury, the Fed, and the SEC in the event that Lehman's situation quickly deteriorated. He and most of the Fed team had already been given a preview of the plan the night before by Lehman, but hearing it presented live proved to be a completely different experience. A former investment banker at Goldman, Shaffrin shook his head in exasperation and announced, "This isn't going to work." As the investor call went on, Shaffrin observed to the staffers, "What's really amazing about this is that these guys are investment bankers who get paid by large corporations for tough advice in tough situations. You know the old saying about how a doctor should never treat himself? It feels like one of those situations." About halfway into the question and answer portion of the call, Michael Mayo, the prominent analyst with Deutsche Bank, addressed the capitalization issue with blunt directness. "To the extent you might need $7 billion to capitalize that entity," his voice boomed over the speakerphone, "and you'll get $3 billion with the spin of part of IMD, the more viable investment management division, how would you get the other $4 billion? Lowett paused as he recalled the explicit instructions given the conversation the firm had had the night before with the J.P. Morgan and Citigroup bankers. "Don't get pinned down talking about any specific numbers. You will be crushed." He was now being asked the one question that he didn't want to answer. "Well, we don't feel that we need to raise that extra amount to cover the $7 billion, he replied, trying to sound confident about the firm's capital position. "Because you will have less sort of leverageable equity in core Lehman than in, you know, where you are at the end of this quarter." In other words, the plan was essentially an accounting gimmick. Lehman would be smaller and less leveraged as a result of the spin-off, and would therefore need less capital. Mayo responded that he had his doubts about Lehman's plan, but in adherence to Wall Street protocol, he left it at that. This was not the place for a showdown. For a few moments, it almost appeared as if Fold would be able to claim victory. Shares of Lehman Brothers opened that morning up 17.4%. The rise might give him the breathing room he needed. Across the Atlantic, a group of senior investors from Barclays in London were likewise intently listening in on the call, taking meticulous notes as they sat in a conference room at the firm's headquarters, known as the Bungalow, in Canary Wharf. They had registered for the call under an assumed name. Bob Diamond, Barclays Capital CEO, had been mulling buying Lehman for months, ever since he had received the call from Bob Steele when he was still at Treasury in April. In June, Diamond had broached the idea with Barclays' board, which had been discussing possible expansion plans in the United States. The group ultimately decided against pursuing Lehman, unless, as John Varley, the firm's chairman, put it, the firm could be bought at a distressed price. Diamond had in turn communicated that message directly back to Steele. But the timing now seemed ripe for a deal. I'm surprised, given how shaky this is, that I actually haven't had a call from Treasury, because it knows that we would be willing to do this at a distressed price, and it's not that far off, Diamond had told Varley only a day earlier. Diamond had been in the middle of giving a recruiting presentation at Wharton, the elite business school at the University of Pennsylvania, on Tuesday, when his cell phone vibrated. Seeing that it was Varley, he abruptly stopped his presentation and walked off the stage. If we're going to meet with the board, we're going to meet with the board tomorrow, Varley told him. Diamond found one of the only three direct overnight flights to Heathrow from Philadelphia. He took the last-minute overnight return flight to London to re-solicit support to buy Lehman. He would have to win over Varley and the board, and do so quickly. Varley was a model of the conservative Englishman, and had married into one of the bank's founding Quaker families. Soft-spoken and courtly, he wore suspenders every day, listed table tennis and fishing as his hobbies, and had far less tolerance for risk than Diamond. Whatever his own professional predilections, however, Varley had always given Diamond a long leash, even if he did maintain a quiet uneasiness with his colleague's appetite for deal-making. The two men had long had a complicated relationship, having both vied for the top job in 2003. Although Varley won the position, Diamond was paid nearly six times what Varley, his superior, made. In 2007, Diamond earned $42 million to Varley's $8.4 million. For years, Diamond had avoided taking a seat on the Barclays board to avoid disclosure of his compensation agreement, which would have landed him squarely in the pages of the British tabloids as a fat cat. Despite his title, Diamond was, to many, the de facto CEO. In 2006, a Dresdner Kleinwort analyst wrote a report provocatively titled, Bob Diamond 3, John Varley 0. As soon as the Lehman call came to an end, the Barclays executives discovered they were in agreement. They'd make a play for the firm. But only, Varley reiterated the point, if they could get it for a song. Diamond went back to his office and phoned Bob Steele at his new number at Wachovia. Remember our conversation about Lehman? He asked. Of course, Steele answered. Well, we're now interested. Lehman's stock may have temporarily stabilized after the earnings call, but only hours later, Fuld was faced with a new problem. Moody's Investors Service announced that it was preparing to place Lehman's credit rating on review, warning that if the firm did not soon enter into a strategic transaction with a stronger financial partner, it would cut its rating. Fuld decided to call John Mack, CEO of Morgan Stanley. He needed options. And unlike his relationship with Ken Lewis and Lloyd Blankfein, he actually trusted Mack. Listen, I really need to do something, Fuld told him. Let's do something together. Mack had always genuinely liked Fuld and was concerned by the stress he could now hear in his voice. But he had no interest in entering into a deal and wondered if Fuld was deluding himself by even making the call. Dick, I want to help, but it just doesn't make any sense. We've talked about this before, Mack said, reminding him of the meeting they had had at his house over the summer. There's so much overlap. After getting off the phone, however, Mack continued to think about the possibility of a deal with Lehman and found that he was intrigued. His initial impulse about its unfeasibility may have been correct when Lehman's stock was trading at $40 a share, but given its current price, a deal might be financially attractive. I've been thinking, he said, after calling Fuld back. I agree with you. We should talk. After Fuld thanked him for reconsidering, Mack paused a moment and then said firmly, Dick, I'm a very straightforward guy. I really like you, but let's be clear. This is not a merger of equals. Only one person can run this. We have to get that up front, now. After an awkward silence, Fuld finally responded, I wasn't thinking that way. And then, after another brief hesitation, added, Let me think about it. I'll call you back. 20 minutes later, Fuld was back on the phone. "Look, you're right," he said, the toll that recent days had taken shading his voice. "I want to do the right thing. Let's see what can be done." Fuld suggested that they set up a meeting between the senior managements of both firms, without Fuld or Mac present. Let them be the ones to decide if it was a good or bad idea. The gathering was arranged for that night at the apartment of Walid Shammah, Morgan Stanley's co-president. Bob Diamond drummed his fingers on the desk as he waited on hold for Tony Ryan at Treasury, whom Bob Steele had suggested he call. "Tony," Diamond began, "do you recall the conversation I had with Steele?" For a moment, Ryan was confused. "Which?" he asked, trying to act as if he knew what Diamond was talking about. "On Lehman. Oh, yes, yes. I wanted to call you because I thought it would be a bit worthwhile for me to talk to Hank. If not, no big thing, but my sense is that we should have a conversation. Ryan said he'd get Paulson to contact him as soon as he could." An hour later, Diamond's secretary informed him that Tim Geithner was on the line. "What can I do to help this along?" he asked. Diamond explained that he was very interested in buying Lehman, if it could be had at a distressed price. "Why don't you call Fuld?" Geithner asked. "You don't understand," Diamond said. "I'm not trying to be provocative here." He told Geithner about their experience trying to buy ABN AMRO, how the deal had fallen apart, and how big an embarrassment it had been for the firm. "We don't want to be seen as dabbling around," Diamond said. "It would be inappropriate." To Geithner, such unnecessary delicacy seemed characteristically British, even if Diamond was an American, and he just listened. "We need to be seen to be invited by you, and shepherded by you," Diamond insisted. "You guys asked me if there was a price at which we'd be interested, and you asked me, if so, what do you need? That doesn't mean I'm going to call Fuld. That's completely different." Geithner, growing frustrated with his equivocation, asked again, "Why can't you just call Fuld? Why can't you do it?" "I'm not going to ask a guy if I can buy him, you know, at a distressed price," Diamond said. "It only works if you guys are looking to arrange a deal. If you're not, fine, no hard feelings, we're okay." However much Barclays may have wished to avoid giving the impression that they might be taking advantage of someone else's misfortune, it was, of course, precisely what they were seeking to do. Ben Bernanke was finding it hard to focus as he sat at a meeting Wednesday afternoon with the local board of the Federal Reserve. Despite the chaos on Wall Street, he had continued making his regular visits to the Fed's regional offices, and this particular trip had brought him to its St. Louis branch, located in a squat limestone building on North Broadway in the city's downtown. The Lehman crisis, however, was never far away. He had already been on the phone with Tim Geithner and Hank Paulson twice about it, once at 8:30 a.m., and again at 1 p.m., with another conversation scheduled for 6 p.m. On the last call, Geithner and Paulson had informed Bernanke of their latest headache, Bank of America's demand to have its capital ratio relaxed. "They are pissed off big time because they thought when they closed on Countrywide, they closed like big boys," Paulson explained. Geithner argued that they needed to get Bank of America to New York by whatever means necessary so that they could begin their due diligence. He was concerned that they were losing critical time. Paulson asked Bernanke to call Ken Lewis himself and see if he could smooth the situation over, stressing again, "We need to get them a glide path." From a temporary office at the St. Louis Fed, Bernanke dialed Lewis. "You really ought to come look at Lehman," Bernanke urged him, still slightly uncomfortable about his new role as dealmaker. "We'll work with you on capital relief and anything you might need." Lewis thanked him for the call and said he planned to send his men up to New York to start discussions with Lehman. Believing he had solved that problem, Bernanke returned to the reason for his trip to St. Louis, to visit with the staffers and spend more time with the St. Louis branch's new president, James Bullard. Bullard had taken over in April from William Poole, one of the more outspoken Fed presidents, who, as it happened, was in Washington that day giving a speech about the Fed's bailouts. Given the ongoing speculation in the market about the need for a government rescue of Lehman, Poole's comments had been attracting an inordinate amount of attention. Unless I've missed something, the Fed and Treasury have been silent about who might have access to Fed resources, except to say that Fannie and Freddie would have access, Poole said during his speech. The Fed said no to New York City in 1975, and no to Chrysler in 1979, he reminded his audience. But with the Bear Stearns precedent, it will not be so easy to say no next time. What I anticipate is that we will not know the limits to Fed lending until the Fed says no to a large, influential firm seeking help. Ken Lewis was leaning hard on the Fed. No sooner had he gotten off the phone with Bernanke than he placed a call to Tim Geithner. Lewis explained that he had had an encouraging call with Mr. Bernanke, but he still couldn't send his team up to New York until the credit situation was officially settled. "We're working to help you on this," Geithner said, politely but firmly. Lewis, however, was beyond accepting such assurances. "We've been dicked around on this for too long," he complained. "If you want us to get involved in Lehman, we're going to need something in writing." Geithner, taken aback at being presented with such an ultimatum, replied, "You've heard what the chairman said he would do. If you don't believe the word of the chairman of the Federal Reserve, we have a larger problem." Realizing that Geithner would not budge on the issue, Lewis finally backed down and agreed to send a team of executives up to begin due diligence that Thursday morning. As Wednesday wore on, Fuld tirelessly continued to work the phones. His call log was a list of virtually every major Wall Street and Washington player, while keeping a watchful eye on the markets for any further signs of panic. The news, it was becoming ever clearer, was grim. After holding up for most of the day, Lehman's shares sank in the last hour of trading, ending at $7.25 a share, a 6.9% decline. Lehman's CDS had also blown out, rising by 135 basis points to 610, which meant that the cost of buying insurance against it going bankrupt had just risen to $610,000 a year to protect $10 million worth of bonds. Investors were effectively betting that the situation was only going to worsen. Any hope that the SpinCo plan was going to turn Lehman's fortunes around was quickly vanishing. Nor were the results of Fuld's phone blitz encouraging. Earlier in the day, he had had a tough conversation with Lloyd Blankfein, who had called to express his frustration that Lehman had ended discussions with Goldman. Alex Kirk and Mark Walsh had held a two-hour-long meeting with Harvey Schwartz of Goldman and his team at a Midtown law firm that morning. But both Kirk and Walsh were skittish about opening up all their books to Goldman and quickly had shut down the talks. Fuld had also spoken to Paulson, who had tried to convince him of the merits of a deal with Barclays. But Fuld was uneasy with that prospect, he explained. With Bank of America already in the hunt, he didn't want to do anything to jeopardize a deal with them. "Dick," Paulson patiently reminded him, "Ken Lewis has turned you down multiple times. The other guys have expressed an interest. We need to pursue both of these options." Fuld, however, seemed more interested in returning to the topic that had so long obsessed him, denouncing the short sellers who, he told Paulson, are going to ruin this firm. He spent 10 minutes again imploring Paulson to call Christopher Cox at the SEC to press him to instate a short-selling ban, to announce an investigation, anything that would give him an opportunity to recover. By late afternoon, Fuld was channeling Stephen Birkenfeld, a layman managing director, whose office was just down the hallway, using his favorite catchphrase about the raids on Lehman's stock: short and distort. In London, Bob Diamond of Barclays was waiting in the bar of 50, a private club on St. James Street, just off of Piccadilly. He had invited Jeremy Isaacs, the former head of Lehman's European operations, for drinks. If there was anyone who could give him an accurate insider view of Lehman, if there was anyone who knew the numbers and culture, it was Isaacs, who had officially announced his plans to retire from the firm just 4 days earlier. Isaacs had left when it became clear that McDade was ascending. In truth, he probably ought not to have come to this drinks engagement, as he was in the midst of negotiating a $5 million severance agreement with Lehman that would literally be approved the following day. As part of the arrangement, he agreed he would not engage in detrimental activity or disparage the firm and would keep company information confidential. Tonight, he would come as close as he could to breaking every provision in that document, with the intention of helping Lehman survive. Walid Shammal's apartment is one of only three townhouses on Manhattan's Upper East Side with its own doorman. The Beaux-Arts limestone structure just off Fifth Avenue contains only 9 apartments. Tucked away a safe distance from Midtown and the banker riffraff on Park Avenue, it was the perfect place to hold a secret meeting to discuss a merger between Lehman and Morgan Stanley. Shammal's wife and children were in London, where he was normally based, so the group had the place to themselves. By 9 o'clock p.m., Shammal, James Gorman, Morgan's other co-president, and the rest of the Morgan Stanley team were milling around his kitchen, waiting for Bart McDade and the Lehman contingent to appear. "Let's at least go through the motions," Shammal instructed his colleagues, but acknowledged that this meeting wouldn't likely lead to anything. When McDade finally arrived with Skip McGee, Mark Shafir, Alex Kirk, and several others, the strain of the day was evident from their drawn and pale faces. Gorman had known McDade from when they were both directors on the board of SIFMA, the Securities, Industry, and Financial Markets Association. Only a week earlier, they had had a tense conversation about Morgan Stanley's exploiting Lehman's turmoil by recruiting away its talent, including the firm's best private wealth advisors. Outraged, McDade had called Gorman and told him, "You have to back off. We got really big problems here, and this is killing us." Ultimately, Gorman stopped the recruiting effort, and the two were seasoned enough professionals to have moved on. Shammal poured a bottle of Tenuta del Onelia, 2001, a $180 a bottle Bordeaux blend, in an effort to settle the mood while keeping things proceeding. Everyone quickly took a seat in the living room. McDade told the group that being there tonight all felt a bit déjà vu. Only a few months earlier, nearly every person in the room had met to discuss the very same topic. Only now, an observation he left unspoken, Lehman was desperate. He then began to explain that Lehman was exploring various options for raising capital, selling assets, or perhaps selling the entire firm. In case that wasn't clear enough, he indicated that if Morgan Stanley was interested in buying the company, he wouldn't press them on terms. He then added that social issues shouldn't hold up a potential deal. Code for the question of who would run the combined businesses. McDade had effectively just given up Fold. "If you want any of us involved, we'll be involved. If you don't want us, we don't have to be. It's not about us anymore," he said. Shafir told the men that a deal might feel like a stretch, but he thought there was an opportunity to remove a good deal of cost from both firms, which was, after all, the baseline logic behind any corporate merger. Despite Shafir's optimistic spin on a potential deal, Shammal was well aware that an agreement of this magnitude would result in a bloodbath, with probably hundreds, if not thousands, of layoffs. He also knew that the upside in any merger could prove elusive. Then, for a good hour, the bankers went over the numbers and the various assets that Lehman owned to determine if there was anything among its holdings that Morgan Stanley might want. But as the discussion went on and papers were passed back and forth, it became clear there was no common ground. Shammal then acknowledged that he didn't think Morgan's board could move quickly enough to be of any real assistance to Lehman in any case, a signal that everyone in the room recognized meant that he believed that Lehman Brothers was simply too far gone. Soon after McDade's team left, Gorman looked solemnly at his group, as if to remind them, "It could be us," but said only, "We just watched guys who are staring into the abyss." Shortly after sunrise, Greg Curl walked across the plaza of the Seagram Building, the 38-story masterpiece of architectural modernism and a Park Avenue landmark. He entered the lobby, checked his watch, and waited for his go-to advisor to arrive. Curl, Bank of America's point man for a possible Lehman Brothers deal, had flown from Charlotte to New York with a team of over 100 executives on Wednesday night to begin their diligence at Sullivan & Cromwell's Midtown Conference Center. To assist them, Curl had enlisted Chris Flowers, a private equity investor whose specialty was the arcana of the banking industry. The two made for an odd couple, given that Curl was a Bank of America veteran with a low profile and had few Wall Street connections, while Flowers was a fast-talking and often profane former Goldman Sachs banker whose daring deals often landed him in the headlines. But as Kroll had considered what to do about Lehman, his first thought was that he wanted Flowers at his side. Flowers could read a balance sheet in less than 30 seconds, and was bold enough to offer an articulate and well-reasoned judgment of it. He had left Goldman in the late 1990s, and started his own private equity firm to invest in banks, a business in which he had done very well indeed, personally pocketing some $540 million from an investment in Shinsei Bank in Japan. He was regularly listed as one of the wealthiest men in America, and when he purchased a townhouse on the Upper East Side for $53 million, it set a record for Manhattan real estate. Kroll trusted very few bankers, but Flowers was an exception. He particularly admired Flowers' dispassionate, no-bullshit approach to deal-making and to life. In 2007, just before the credit crisis hit, they had bid together on Sallie Mae, the student loan company. They soon realized the deal was a mistake, and for the rest of the year they worked together to try to undo it. Carl hadn't held the Sallie Mae investment against Flowers, largely because Flowers was ultimately able to get them out of it by invoking an escape hatch in the merger agreement, with ensuing legal fireworks. Flowers could be useful for more than just providing advice, as Kroll knew that he might be eager to invest in Lehman alongside Bank of America. Kroll thought he might even be willing to take Lehman's riskiest assets. When he sought out Flowers just 24 hours earlier, Kroll had found him in Tokyo, where Flowers had been in the middle of a board meeting of Shinsei. "You'll want to look at Lehman Brothers, and we want to look at it in partnership with you," Kroll told him. "Can you get back to New York for this purpose?" Flowers hardly needed persuading, and quickly arranged for a car to the airport to make the 14-hour flight back to Manhattan. When Flowers arrived, clearly wearing the jet lag on his face, he had brought along Jacob Goldfield, a fellow Goldman alum. Goldfield happened to be the banker depicted in Roger Lowenstein's When Genius Failed as surreptitiously downloading all of Long-Term Capital Management's information into a laptop during Goldman's attempt to assist the beleaguered firm. It was Goldfield whom Alex Kirk of Lehman had mentioned in his nervous comment to Fold about providing information to Goldman Sachs a day earlier. Goldfield also knew Lehman well. He had helped Hank Greenberg examine the firm back in the spring, when Greenberg was part of a group of investors who bought $6 billion of common and preferred shares. On the flight over, Flowers had studied Lehman's second quarter report from the day before and had focused on what he knew was going to be the big discussion point, the value of Lehman's real estate assets. Could they possibly be worth $25 to $30 billion? Kroll, Flowers, and Goldfield set up operations in a conference room that Sullivan and Cromwell provided, laid out with coffee and pastries. This was going to be a long day. With 24 hours to mull over Lehman's SpinCo plan, Wall Street analysts turned against it, and the firm, en masse. They blasted out skeptical emails to clients on Thursday morning, adding to the weight that was already dragging down Lehman's shares. The stock price had ended the previous day down 7% at $7.25. It was about to sink even lower. Management did not successfully put to rest the issues that had been pressuring the stock, William Tonona, an analyst at Goldman Sachs, declared in his email. Michael Mayo, an analyst who had kept a buy rating on Lehman shares since April 2007, sent out an even bleaker prognosis, given his concerns about the possible fallout as credit rating firms grew more bearish about Lehman. "The change in rating agency posture is an unexpected negative that may create a distressed sale situation." In other words, a fire sale could be next. His buy rating was summarily removed. Guy Moszkowski of Merrill Lynch was also grim on the subject of Lehman's sale prospects, writing that the firm could be forced to accept a take-under, Wall Street parlance for a takeover at a price below where a company's shares are trading. Even analysts who believed that Lehman was basically sound were beginning to see that it had become a matter of perception trumping fundamentals. Lehman's tumbling stock price inflamed the market's fears, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy that was forcing Lehman to find a buyer, and fast. As Wall Street analysts seemed poised to write the epitaph for Dick Fuld's firm, the only person to come to his public defense was John Mack, the man who Fuld had hoped would be his merger partner. Mack was quoted in the Times that morning as saying, "He is as feisty as ever, but there is no question this is wearing on him, as it would wear on anyone." In private, however, Mac had just delivered shattering news in a phone call to Fuld. He didn't believe there was a good reason for Morgan Stanley to move forward with the talks. However, there were still signs of life. Tim Geithner confirmed to Fuld that Barclays was indeed interested in bidding for the company, even though they had not contacted Fuld directly, and gave him Diamond's phone number in London. "He knows you'll be calling," Geithner assured him. "I understand I'm supposed to call you," Fuld said when he later reached Diamond. Diamond, however, was clearly flustered, as he thought he had been explicit with Geithner that he didn't want to talk directly with Fuld about a deal. A deal would have to be brokered by the U.S. government. "I think we should talk," Fuld said, trying to engage with him. "I don't see an opportunity for us here," Diamond answered. Fuld couldn't understand what was going on. He had been told by Geithner to make this contact, and now Diamond was telling him that he wasn't interested. Unwilling to force the issue, he ended the conversation and called back Geithner. "I just got off the phone with Bob Diamond," he told Geithner heatedly. "He says he's not interested. I thought you said he wanted to talk to us." "Yes, he does," Geithner insisted. "You should call him back." 5 minutes later, he tried Diamond again. "I just told you that we're not interested," Diamond repeated. Fuld, by now feeling as if he were part of some kind of charade, again phoned Geithner. "I don't know what's going on here. I've called him twice, and both times he says he doesn't want to talk to me. You tell me he's interested, he says he's not." Geithner promised he'd reach out to Diamond and urged Fuld to try him one last time. On his final attempt, Diamond was suddenly willing to talk. "We're going to be flying over tonight," Diamond said. "I'll have a team ready to go by Friday morning." With that sentence, it was official. Barclays and Bank of America were now in competition. What Fuld hadn't been aware of was that for the entire morning, Diamond and his team had already been in contact with Geithner and Paulson and had come to an agreement that Barclays would examine Lehman's books as soon as possible. Fuld's role in any rescue effort was becoming a polite formality. Before he left for New York that night, Diamond had hoped to receive some assurances that his trip would be worthwhile. On his call with Paulson, Diamond had specifically asked if Barclays could be the exclusive bidder for Lehman. He had read the news about Bank of America's interest, and he knew firsthand that it could be a formidable rival and a potential spoiler. A year earlier, Bank of America had jumped into the takeover battle for the Dutch bank, ABN AMRO, a duel that pitted Barclays against a group that included the Royal Bank of Scotland. By agreeing to buy Chicago's LaSalle Bank from ABN for $21 billion, Bank of America had effectively snatched the crown jewel of the deal, which the RBS group was particularly coveting, and whose absence from the portfolio made it more difficult to outbid Barclays. In the end, Barclays lost the bidding war for ABN, but Bank of America still got LaSalle. The failed deal was a blow for Diamond and his expansionist dreams, and he had always believed that Bank of America had hugely overpaid for the property. "If B of A is going to be there, don't embarrass us," Diamond told Paulson. "Don't get us to do a deal and have B of A top us." "You can't have an exclusive," Paulson responded. "But let me tell you, you're in a strong position, and I'll make sure you're not embarrassed." Before the call ended, Diamond wanted to make another thing clear. He was looking for a Jamie deal. In other words, he might come looking for some form of government help. Paulson stated firmly that no assistance from the government would be forthcoming, but added, "We'll figure out how to get you help." As Tom Russo burst into Dick Fuld's office, the glum look on his face got Fuld's immediate attention, which was fairly remarkable, considering the general somberness on the 31st floor. "What?" Fuld barked. "I just got off the phone with Tom Baxter," Russo said, referring to the general counsel of the Federal Reserve of New York. "He said that Geithner wants you to resign from the board of the NY Fed." Russo paused to allow Fuld to take that news in before adding, "That, given our position, it's too complicated, too many conflicts." Geithner's request should not have come as a shock. For if there was even the possibility that the government was going to have to put up money as part of a deal to find Lehman a buyer, the last thing he would have wanted was to be seen as helping a member of his own board, an insider. The slightest appearance of favoritism could prove disastrous. Fuld, even so, took the message as a personal slight and stared morosely down at the table. For a moment, it looked as if he might cry, but he steadied himself and whispered, "I can't believe this." Together, Fuld and Russo dictated a resignation letter addressed to Stephen Friedman, chairman of the board of directors. "Dear Steve, it is with deep regret that I hereby tender my resignation as a member of the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. In light of my current business situation at Lehman Brothers, I unfortunately do not have the time to devote to board matters and, therefore, feel it is in the best interests of the board that I resign, effective immediately. I have very much enjoyed my time on the board and have enormous respect for both the board and the institution. Thank you. Sincerely, Dick." With a restrained but heavy sigh, Fuld added his signature, scribbling a huge D in place above Dick. At 70 Pine Street, the pressure was building as Bob Willemstad paced his office ahead of a crucial meeting that morning with the credit rating agency, which had been making menacing noises about downgrades. He had just gotten off the phone with Geithner to follow up on their meeting about turning AIG into a broker-dealer, and to apply a little additional pressure. "We're a little busy right now with Lehman," Geithner apologized, "but let's talk again tomorrow morning." It was only 10:30 a.m., but the marketplace was already sensing the nervousness that Willemstad had been trying his best to conceal all week. The cost to insure the debt of AIG had jumped by 15% to 612 basis points, the highest level in its history. That meant that it would cost investors $612,000 to insure $10 million of AIG's debt every year for the next 5 years. With Lehman clearly desperate to raise money, investors were betting AIG was soon going to face the same struggle. It might also have to pay out astronomical amounts to investors who were loading up on insurance to protect themselves from a potential Lehman default. To make matters worse, Hank Greenberg, being deposed that day by the New York State Attorney General about previous questionable accounting practices at AIG, badgered Willemstad at every chance. "What the hell are you people waiting for?" he demanded, wanting to know why efforts to shore up the company hadn't been moving more quickly. Amid all the other pressures, Willemstad was still pressing to settle the long-running lawsuit that Greenberg had brought against the firm after he had been ousted. He had been counting on Greenberg's helping the firm raise some capital by leveraging his relationship in Asia, where he had built AIG into a powerhouse that dominated the tricky and semi-transparent Japanese and Chinese markets. He told Greenberg he'd have his lawyer, Jamie Gamble, at Simpson Thacker, set up a meeting with Greenberg's lawyer, David Boies, to try to come up with a settlement Greenberg could live with. Perhaps the most pressing problem weighing on Willemstad was the result of a conversation he had had with Jamie Dimon earlier in the week. "We seem to be not getting enough done," Willemstad had told him, urging him to help raise capital or lend the firm the money himself. "Well, you know, you got a bigger problem than we had anticipated," Dimon replied. "Our models show you're running out of money next week." It was then that Willemstad accepted the fact that J.P. Morgan might well not be willing to provide any further funds. AIG's treasurer, Robert Gender, had already warned him that that might be the case. But Willemstad hadn't fully believed him. "J.P. Morgan's always tough," he reminded Gender. "Citi will do anything you ask them to do. They just say yes." But the prudent Gender only acidly replied, "Quite frankly, we can use some of the discipline that J.P. Morgan is pushing on us." Dimon had been encouraging Willemstad to just come up with a plan, even if it wasn't perfect. "It doesn't have to be in place," Dimon told him. "You just have to tell the markets what you're going to do, and then go and do it. If you need to raise capital, tell them you need to raise capital." A lot of good that did Lehman yesterday, Willemstad thought. Finally, the time came for the dreaded meeting with Moody's. Steve Black from J.P. Morgan had come downtown to lend some credibility to the affair, and to help answer questions about AIG's plans to raise capital. It was one thing for Willemstad to state that he had every intention of raising capital, and quite another entirely to have the president of J.P. Morgan affirm that he intended to support the company in that effort. The stakes were high. If the agency cut AIG's credit rating by even one notch, it could trigger a collateral call of $10.5 billion. If Standard & Poor's followed suit, which was likely, "the blind leading the blind," Willemstad said of them, the figure would rise to $13.3 billion. Should that happen, and AIG be unable to come up with the extra capital, it would be a virtual death sentence. No more than 15 minutes into the meeting, the Moody's analyst made it clear that the agency would downgrade AIG by at least one notch, and possibly two. By Willemstad's calculations, if they did so on Monday, the company would have at least 3 days